introduced myself and everything. We talked for a while. And finally, we got the machine fixed. We got the hum out. I told him to knock down a few walls and change things around. So the basic design of Studio C is what I participated in. Studio D was built actually long after that. I have nothing to do with that at all. I said D originally, I meant C. The only studio that I really had anything to do with was C, and that was many years ago, and things have happened since then, too. So that's the answer to that question. I'm not culpable for any of the weirdnesses that go on here, but we'll talk today and hopefully share some information, yeah.
Do you have anything to do with the new studio that's being built?
That remains to be seen so far, no. I helped in the initial blueprints and stuff and design when the studio, then the money wasn't there, the studio never was built. But that was a few years ago. It'll get filled now, and we'll see what happens with that. Okay, what we're supposed to be talking about today is outboard gear. That doesn't mean trolling motors and fishing. What it means is the stuff that's not in the console. In other words, stuff that's mounted in racks against the wall or roll around in racks or something. Basically, that's what outboard gear means. But I'm going to make it more narrow than that because I'm going to be coming here and talking with you twice. And the one thing we're going to talk about is going to kind of flow into the next thing. So basically what we're going to cover today is echo and reverb to start off. And then we're going to talk a little about compression and limiting. How it works, how it's used, and the technical aspects of it. So you feel real familiar with it. Okay. Now, as you talk about these things, you naturally start to talk about things like digital delay and stuff like that, and you get into some more advanced stuff that's been coming out in the last few years. And digital is really where the audio business is going. And so the next time I come down here, we're going to talk about the current trends in the recording business in terms of the technical stuff, in other words, equipment that's being developed, what's available. And we'll get into a little bit of that today, but next time I come down, we're going to talk about digital theory. We're going to talk about what it is, how it works, some of the equipment that's available, more advanced stuff, things like harmonizers and stuff like that. We'll get into talking about synthesizers today. We'll see how much time we have. We'll talk about maybe a synthesizer, digital recording, stuff like that next time. So it's kind of these two talks are kind of connected, okay? So we'll start off. We'll see how far we get today, and then we'll just go until people look bored, and we'll stop, and then we'll pick it up next time. So let's start off with echo and reverb. It's funny because on the console, you know, you always have what's called echo sends and echo returns. And so the word echo is used on the console, but we also talk about reverb. And maybe it's not clear in people's minds exactly what the difference is between these things. Maybe it's perfectly clear. Too late. Okay. This is a box. No, actually, this is not a box. This is a plan view of a room. Right? Plan view is where you're floating on the ceiling, looking down. Okay. And this is a sound. So you've never done that? This is a sound source. And this is a listener. This is a sound source, this is a listener. You can tell it's a listener because he's got ears. Can everyone see the blackboard? Who can't see the blackboard? Can't see the blackboard? You don't want to tell me you can't see the blackboard. Okay, if you can't see the blackboard, fake it. Look at someone else's notes or something. Okay, obviously there's sound that comes directly to the listener. Okay. And then there's sound that's reflected off the walls. This is a very simplistic picture because actually this is a sound source that radiates 360 degrees, maybe more directional in one way or another, but sound is bouncing off the ceiling and the floor and everything else. But there's two kinds of sound. There's the direct sound, which is the first thing that hits your ears, and then the second thing are these echoes that come off the walls and the floor. And since sound travels, does anyone know the speed of sound?
11,000
miles per second. No, that's light. 1,100 feet per second, right. Okay. So that's not that fast. I mean, you know, it's faster than most things, but it's not as fast as light. It takes some time to get where it's going. So there's actually a delay between the path of this sound and the path of that sound. Almost all the sound we hear has some kind of reverberation to it, indoors mostly. And different rooms sound different, I'm sure you've noticed that. And recording studios have a particular sound of their own. Actually, you know, there are rooms that are designed to have no reflection at all. You know about those? Anechoic chamber. Did you talk about that? Anyone ever been in one?
No.
No? You have not?
Yeah, they're really bad for your brain.
I enjoy it very much.
About the first 10 minutes after that, it's a little creepy.
Well, for those of you who haven't been in an anechoic chamber, I'll describe the experience and why, the way it felt to me. You walk into this room, which looks kind of weird, and I built one in a studio in New York for a nut who was into sound effects. And this guy, he was really a nut, and he's gone to the airport and records 747s with his Nagra tape recorder and everything. He had a whole library of sound effects. You can hear any sound. You know, like the sound of a company piece falling into a glass of port wine, for instance. He'd pull it off the shelf and say, guy went about 350 pounds, he was bald, and walked everywhere with his tape recorder. You know, he was independently wealthy, this guy. His wife was the inheritor of the Arthur Conan Doyle estate. And, this guy, he was like a big kid. And he took this whole brownstone house and had it renovated and made it into studios. Everything was, you know, Neumann mics everywhere, and EMT, all top quality, Studer machines, everything. Real expensive. He hired a carpenter from Columbia to come up and do all teak wood. Everything was teak wood. Anyway, he had me build an anechoic chamber in the house to record sound effects and stuff. And the experience of going in there is that you don't hear anything at first. And then you hear three things. First thing you hear is your heart. But you don't just hear your heart, you hear your blood going through your blood vessels. You know, like bumps. And then you hear your breath going in and out. And then if you sit and listen a little longer, the third thing you hear is you begin to hear the signal to noise ratio in your nervous system. You start to hear this. It's a great place to sit around a while and just experience it. Anyway, back to the clocks. Normally, there are echoes outdoors. There's echoes off of trees and off of the road or whatever happens to be around. Even, you know, plants and things, everything has some reflection. It's very hard to find an environment with no reflection. So, normally what we hear, we're conditioned to hear sound with reflections, and we can almost tell when you listen to a record, you get a mental image of where that sound is recorded. Now normally in pop recording, the acoustic environment is synthesized through the use of additional echo and reverb effects and things to create a certain ambience, a certain sound. The other type of recording is where you actually go to a club or go to a hall or something and you record live, right, with hanging mics or mics on stands or something, and you record the ambience of the room in which the music was originally performed. These are two different things, right? But the idea of the studio usually is either A, to simulate a natural environment, or B, to create some kind of special effect that you don't hear naturally but sounds interesting, so people will say, hey, listen to that, right? Okay, let's go to the natural situation first, and then we'll go to the artificial situation. I'm going to erase this, and I'm going to draw a different picture. This picture is a graph, and this graph is a graph of time versus amplitude. Okay, this is amplitude on the y-axis and time on the x-axis. Okay, and just like those things you had in algebra and geometry and all that stuff in school. And what we'll do is we'll put this here as a sound. Okay, and then what you get here is this, and this, and this, and this. Bunch of that is a lot of light. Okay, this is the initial sound. We'll call it I, initial sound. And we'll call this E1, E2, E3, E4, etc. Echo 1, echo 2, echo 3, echo 4. This is a very simplistic drawing, but you get the idea. The initial sound is louder, and then the echoes fade away, and you learn about envelopes.
No. How many people learned about envelopes? How many people didn't learn about envelopes? Okay, we'll learn about envelopes. You're supposed to know that already. That's supposed to be in the first lecture. Somebody goofed. Okay. Anyway, this gets softer and softer, and we get a curve here of amplitude. You know what amplitude is?
Right.
And some of you don't understand. Okay, this falls off. Now, the normal kind of thing, when you think of echo, you think of, you go up to a canyon or something, you stand up on the rim, and you yell, oh! It goes, whoa, right? That's what we call discrete echo. It's sometimes called slap echo, right? Slap back or slap back. It's where you hear a repetition of the sound. Okay? And that's what's normally, the word echo technically refers to that effect. What's called distinct echo, slap echo. Okay? Now, what we normally have in the studio is not slap echo. What we have is something which is really reverb. Reverb is where you have multiple echoes spaced so closely together that your computer, that you wear on your neck between your ears, can't distinguish between the separate sounds. Okay, because this computer up here likes to average things, right? That's its business. Are you with me?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, okay. See, it likes to average things. For instance, you go to the movies, right? Go to the movies, and the pictures go by at 24 frames a second. But you don't sit there and go blink, blink, blink. This is blink, blink. You see moving pictures, right? I mean, usually. Okay. Because your brain says, I'm not going to hassle all those little pictures. It just averages everything together and you see moving pictures. Well, it does the same thing with sound. Now, actually, if you ask the acoustic technicians and the psychoacousticians and all them scientific people, they'll tell you that the brain, the average person, cannot distinguish between separate sounds that come closer together than about 30 milliseconds. Okay, average. What that means is that if you have two sounds that are more than 30 milliseconds apart in time, you understand millisecond?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. If somebody's interrupting me, I assume everybody's cool. You see, people are afraid to put their hands up. That's the problem. Okay, 30 milliseconds. If it's more than 30 milliseconds apart, your cantaloupe up here says, two sounds, right? And if they're closer than 30 milliseconds, your cantaloupe up here says, hmm. What was that? One sound, but I'm not sure. Okay. Now, this again is the average person. Now, I don't know where they get these average people, because, you know, depending on who you are and your state of consciousness at the time, you hear differently, right? So, sometimes you may be able to hear sounds that are closer together than 30 milliseconds, and sometimes not. But if this appears on the test, folks, there's the number to plug into the answer. It's the name of the game, isn't it? Okay. Now, this portion of the curve here, the echoes are closer together than 30 milliseconds, and we call that portion of the curve reverb. So the definition of reverb is when the echoes are closer together than 30 milliseconds, or you can't distinguish through your hearing apparatus that you're hearing separate echoes, but they blend together to give a fullness. Okay. So reverb is echo that's repeated so quickly that you can't distinguish it as a separate echo. Whereas slap echo or repeat echo is where you can hear distinct repetitions of the sound. Okay, so is the definition clear to everybody? Okay. Now, I'm going to talk about envelopes because if I don't, nobody else will, and then you'll miss it. But it's not really part of today's topic, but let me just do something here. What you have to do now is shift gears, okay? Shift into neutral, take a deep breath. We're going to change topics, okay? And then we'll go back on the echo and do it again. I know this distracts people sometimes, but I just want you to have this. It's really part of the acoustics lecture. So pretend it's a week ago. Okay, you don't know anything. Okay. Amplitude versus time again. This is, I walk up to a piano, okay? I walk up to a piano and I push the I didn't even have to push the pedal down. I take my finger and I hit a key and I hold the key down. Okay, I go, bong, right? And what you have is this. You have a sound that is loud when the hammer hits the string, and then it kind of falls off slowly, slowly, and then a little faster, and a little faster, and then disappears. Okay? This type of drawing is called an envelope. An envelope is, by definition, amplitude versus time. And what it shows you is that the, what type of instrument is a piano?
Percussion.
Percussion, right? It's not a string instrument. It's a percussion instrument. It has hammers that hit things. Okay. Yeah, you know, Ben Franklin invented a glass piano. Did you know that? Yeah. Yeah, that's for us. Some people know about that. He took all these glass bowls and he put them on a spindle and in a trough of water. You ever touch the top of a wine glass with your finger?
Oh, yeah.
Right? And then he'd take his fingers and pedal this thing and these bowls would spin around all different sizes and touch them with his fingers and play on them. Boom, boom, boom. It's a real spacey sound. Really nice stuff. I don't know why they don't do that anymore. Anyway, this initial sound. Ben Franklin is cool. This is called the attack. Okay, the attack. The initial beginning of the sound is called the attack. And the time it takes from zero, when the hammer first hits, the time it reaches full amplitude is called the rise time. Okay, now this part of the tone is generally called sustain. Roughly, now this is a general definition. You don't know really where it starts right after the attack and goes to the point where this seems to start to fall more, and this is called the decay. Okay, and this particular type of sound, decay, D-E-C-A-Y, decay. Okay, so this particular type of sound, you have attack, sustain, and decay. It's really just attack and decay, because it's really decaying all the time. But you could call this part of it sustain, because after you first hit the note, there's a subjective interval where the note doesn't seem to get less in loudness, then it seems to fall off. Now, you have to mentally imagine what different instruments would sound like. Suppose this is not a piano anymore. Suppose this is a Hammond V3 or something, right? You know, an organ, electric organ, right? You come over and you push down a key, you get something that looks like this. Right? It doesn't have, the attack just comes up and doesn't have any peak. It just comes up to the amplitude. You don't put your foot on the pedal, you just leave it set. Comes up to where your volume is set, goes across. When you take your foot up, finger off the gate, it just stops, right? You understand? Okay, so this doesn't really have an attack. It has a rise time. You could call this line here the attack. Sustain. And you could call this release. It's not a decay because it occurs almost quickly. A very fast decay is called a release. It just lets go. Okay. So these terms, attack, sustain, decay, release, are terms that are used to refer to what we call the envelope or the picture of amplitude versus time. Let's just take one more instrument as an example. I'm trying to pick things that are very different. Let's take a crash cymbal. Okay. A crash cymbal, right? You hit it with a stick. And you get a real sharp attack, and then a whole bunch of little peaks here, and the thing comes down, looks kind of like that, right? Okay, it looks very different than any of the other ones. It has a real sharp, this peak goes way, way up. Real sharp peak. By the way, peaks that don't last a long time, but are high in amplitude are called what?
Transients.
Transients. You learned about that.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you learned about that probably before you started recording, because if you don't know about that, you get distortion. Okay. Shift gears again. That's all there is about envelopes. Just thought you ought to know it. So they're not just things you put letters in. Okay. Back to echo and reverb. Now, how do you get the sound in a studio called echo or reverb? There's lots of different ways. That's what we're talking about. And we'll just list them here. One is acoustic echo. Two, it would be something called a acoustic delay line. I just write DL. You can write delay line if you'll go home and you won't know what that means. I need a little shorthand, saves time. Then we have plate. Yeah, let's put spring first. Spring. Springs. Plates. Electronic. Huh? What else?
Foil.
What?
Foil.
Foil's plate.
Oh, okay.
quite a different type of plate. Yeah, we'll go into that. Okay. These are all artificial systems, except for this first one. How many people sing in the shower?
Everybody.
Oh, come on.
Everybody sings in the shower.
Everybody sings in the shower.
Why do you sing in the shower?
That's good.
Nobody can. You sound like Pavarotti or something, right? You sing in the shower. Huh? Yeah, well, why does it sound good?
Tile.
It's all reflection, right? It's all the sound reflected, and there's this great ambience, and you can just hit that one note. It just kind of sounds really good. It's the resonant frequency of the shower stall, you know? You get right at that key and go, and it just sounds really good. Okay. So what they used to do in the old days to get echo was they would have certain studios that had a real nice sound, a real nice echo sound to them, you know, because the room was built with a lot of hard walls and things. And so when they wanted echo, they'd send the vocalist to that room and record them in that room, and had a nice sound. That's called acoustic echo. It's like, you know, if you go sing in Carlsbad Caverns or something, it has a certain sound. You know, it has a certain resonant sound, or maybe St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York or something. Well, I had this like Studio F at RCA Studios in New York, was real famous for its echo. People would go there to record because they liked the sound of it. Well, then what they decided to do after that was they would take a speaker and they'd put it in the room, right, and a microphone. This way the vocalist didn't have to go in the other room. All they had to do was flip a switch, take that signal, amplify it, put it through the speaker in the other room, pick it up on a mic, feed it back into the board, and they had a room which was just an echo room, okay? And that's where the word echo chamber came from. A room is a chamber, right? So echo chamber was really a room called, you know, like what, you know, it's an echo chamber, echo room. Now, the problem is with construction costs being what they are nowadays, it's too expensive to build echo rooms. I mean, you know, we need rooms for other stuff like studios and things. And to build a room and just stick a speaker and a microphone in it and nothing else, I mean, you know, back in the 40s and 50s, that was cool. Nowadays, you don't do that stuff. You know, contractors make a lot of money. So we use these synthetic devices to simulate that acoustical echo sound. Okay? I'll tell you an interesting story about acoustical echo. I'll tell you a story about that nut I built the studio for in New York. I should call the guy that. He was kind of a nice guy. It was a brownstone house, you know, a three-story tenement, you know, and he ripped the whole inside out and rebuilt the whole thing. Since he was rather portly, he installed an elevator. The thing only had three stories, but he liked to go up and down the elevator. It only had three buttons. And so he said, you know, we need an echo chamber. So he had this great idea. He said, we'll mount a speaker on the bottom of the elevator. We'll put a microphone on the bottom of the elevator shaft. And then depending on which floor the elevator stopped on, we'll have different delay times. Good idea, huh? So I said,
did he come here?
You told me he saw
him. He did come here.
So I said, well, okay. Why not? I mean, I was working by the hour. So I wired the whole thing up, took a week or so. And we have a special echo board and everything, and it was really great. You could stop the elevator, and you lock the elevator so nobody can come in, you know. Start pounding on the door. The elevator thing, where's the elevator? But the problem is, in New York City, there's a lot of traffic. And the elevator shaft is open at the top. And so you get this really neat echo sound together with about four fire engines, eight police cars, 12 cars, city buses going by, everything. So it was totally useless. But the principle behind it is valid. In other words, the size of the space as it varies determines the delay time. And the delay time is really the difference between the initial sound and the first echo. That's what we call delay time. In other words, the apparent size of the room that's conveyed to you psychoacoustically in your brain is determined by how long it takes that first echo to come back. A natural sounding, yeah.
With a fairly large echo chamber, would it be possible to like adjust the delay time by moving the speaker relative to the microphone, so you move the speaker and the microphone
near
the wall?
You can adjust the speaker distance to the microphone to adjust delay time, but also some of it's determined just by the physical construction of the room. And there are a lot of other factors in what echo sounds like. For instance, you may have a long delay time it doesn't sound good, and you may have a longer lifetime that sounds good. And the difference is the proportions of the different reverberant frequencies in the decay part of the curve, and how those reverberations come to you, what, how close together they are, how far away they are, what frequencies are emphasized. For instance, in a natural environment, that decay curve is frequency dependent. In other words, your high frequencies decay faster than your lower frequencies. Okay? So in a synthetic echo, you want to simulate that type of thing. You want it to sound natural, right? I mean, what you want in an echo, let's say you're building a studio, right? What you want is, you don't want to spend a lot of money. You want to get something that sounds good. That's the situation. Okay? And so the question is, what kind of echo should you buy, right? That's what this lecture is all about. Okay. Acoustic delay lines. I include these in this list simply because it's another funny story, but they're not available too much anymore. Has anyone here ever heard of a Cooper time cube?
Yeah.
Yeah, how many people heard of a Cooper time cube? The old timers. A Cooper time cube, it sounds real science fiction-y. A Cooper time cube. Well, actually, you were 6 when you heard about it. See, have you ever played with a garden hose when you were a kid, you know, where you picked up one end and you said, "Hey, Mikey!" Yeah, here we go! Can you talk around corners? Yeah, you played that game?
Yeah.
Sure. Right? You can go 100 feet away and you can whisper and you can hear you. Well, this guy, Cooper, took a piece of hose and he stuck it in a black box. And he coiled it all up, and then at one end he put a microphone, and the other end a little speaker. And he sealed the whole thing up and had it black epoxy and shut. And he said, "Here I have a delay line." And he didn't tell anybody what was in the box, which was just a hunk of polyethylene tubing. And there was a neat little panel that rack mounted. You see, he didn't have any, he couldn't vary the delay time. Actually, there were two tubes in the box, and there was a little U-shaped connector you could plug in, the hook them both together, and twice the delay time. It was either 30 milliseconds or 60 milliseconds. You'll still see these things sitting around studios nowadays, gathering dust. They're very hard to resell. It's a, it's a black box about this big, full of plastic tube. Cost about $400. Let that be a lesson to you, folks. Okay. So the acoustic delay line is actually nothing but a hunk of pipe with a microphone on it. And you ever hear what your voice sounded like when you talk to your garden hose? Okay. Well, there wasn't too much else available then. It was a pretty neat thing at the time. 1951 or something. Okay, springs. Everybody here has heard spring echo, right? Everybody's heard it. Spring echo is everywhere because it's in guitar amps, right? It's in your guitar amp. It's in your cheap mixers, your Tapco, your Tascam, and your cheap boards will have reverb built in them, which is basically a spring. Right, has anybody here hasn't heard spring echo? That's that thing that when you kick it, it goes. Right. Someone comes over, you're mixing, you know, and someone comes over and sits down, puts their hand on the board where your mixer is right there, and like that, right? That's spring echo. Spring echo is widely found because spring echo is cheap. It's nothing more than a spring that you'd use to close the outhouse door with. Just one of those little door closer springs, basically, is what it is, you know? You know those springs? They're about this long.
Yeah.
Kind of floppy. Okay. And all they do is they take, on one end, they put a little hook connected to a microphone, a little transducer, and on the other end, they have a little hook connected to another transducer, and one feeds the signal in, and the other one picks it up, and the vibration goes down the spring, and it vibrates back and forth, right? This is the principle, pretty simple. We can go into it a little more depth. Now, springs have certain advantages and certain disadvantages. This is where you write advantages and disadvantages. Okay. The advantages are, A, they're cheap. B, they can have a very natural sound if they're used sparingly. Okay? Because their natural frequency characteristics correlate with those of a natural environment. In other words, high frequencies decay faster. Also, they have a built-in initial delay to them, so that the first echo takes a little while to come back out of them, which gives them a natural sound also. So they're cheap, they can, if they're used right, have a fairly natural sound. The disadvantages are, the main disadvantage of springs is that they sound like springs. They sound boingy, twangy, right? I mean, you know what I'm talking about. You've heard them, right? I mean, how can I convey this in words if you haven't heard it? You know, you'll file away the word boingy in there somewhere, but until you've heard it, you don't really know what it sounds like. It has a slightly unnatural sound, particularly on percussive instruments, like drums, or piano, or attack of a guitar that's being picked, something like that. On a voice, traditionally used on voice, and not too bad. But on instruments that have a percussive attack, you hear a particular boing, particularly if you crank up the echo a little, it sounds very unnatural. It sounds like a spring. It sounds like a hunk of metal. Now, certain things have been done to improve the sound of springs throughout the years. And the main echo that's used here in the studio is spring echo. It's cheap. the echo is Mike Mix echo. How many people here heard of Mike Mix? Okay, Mike Mix now has come out with a cheap echo at about $1,200. When this was put in, this was their cheapest at that time. It hadn't come out with a cheaper one. It was about $2,500, which is cheap as echo systems go, as you'll see as we get into this talk some more. But it's basically two cardboard tubes, gold, painted gold. They're stuck on the wall down in the basement down there, and they have springs inside of it. But not just one spring, they have multiple springs. Now, the way they decided to make these springs sound better, let's go to the most famous spring echo of all, the AKG BX20. The BX20 was developed by Philips in Holland, who are also the inventors of the cassette. You know the cassette? Okay. You know it was a Dutch invention? Anybody here from Holland? It's a Dutch invention. Yeah, you got Dutch blood back there, okay. It's a Dutch invention, the cassette. They invented it for dictating machines. Little did they know. Boy, are they great again. Anyway, they also invented the spring echo, and what they did was they had a team of Dutch scientists all working on the problem of why spring the sound boingy. And yeah, they write research papers about these things, you know.
Why are springies boingy?
Why are springies boingy? Why are binden springen geboingen? And what they did was they took these springs, see, and they twisted them all out of shape. What they did, they took a spring and they made it look like this. And then they dipped it in sulfuric acid to eat away the metal so that the diameter of the wire varied as it went. This is one piece of wire. It microfied, expanded bigger than life. And you can see that the diameter of the wire varies. Okay. Now what this did was, it changed the natural resonant frequency of the spring, which creates its boinginess, and eliminated it because the spring was so bad out of shape, it still had the harmonic characteristics that if you stimulated one end, the sound would go down to the other end and come back, so you could still get reverb out of it. But since it no longer had a fundamental frequency at which it resonated, because it was so, the coils were bent and spaced and everything, and the wire was not a uniform diameter, it got rid of that boingy sound and gave a much more natural sound. Now you take about 7 or 8 of these springs, all tuned to slightly different lengths, put them in a box together, and stimulate them together, and you get a very natural sound. So they patented it. And they sold it for about, the initial BX20 cost about $5,000. Now it costs closer to $7,000 or $8,000. They make a cheaper version called the BX10, which is about half that price. But it has a real nice sound for springs. Now, what one of their engineers escaped and came over to America and founded a country called Mike Mix, see? And as soon as the patent expired, right, he knew about the patent. On the day the patent expired, he developed the Mike Mix, which is basically a copy of the AKG Echo for about half the price. It's a copy of the BX20. What he did was he took off the teak box and everything else and just rack mounted it in the black container, made it real simple, and it sounds pretty good. The disadvantage of the Mike Mix is it has a very subtle, unobtrusive concert hall kind of sound. It's not particularly suitable for mixing. It's not particularly suitable for rock and roll, but it has a natural type of sound, and of spring echoes, if you can't afford an AKG, a Mike Mix is your next best bet. And then there are all the cheap springs, which are the outhouse springs that go in the guitar amps and stuff, which we don't really consider for professional use. Okay, does anybody have any questions about spring? Okay. Let's talk about plates. Is this fun? Yeah. I want to erase this.
I can't read.
Okay. Well, somebody next to you copied it all down, every little twist and twinkle. Okay. The way plates work is this. You ever take a big piece of sheet metal and go like this? It sounds like thunder, right? I used to get such a kick out of that. Walk around with a 4x6 piece of galvanized, scare people out of the way. Okay. What it is basically is a big sheet of metal. That big square piece of metal, about all 3 feet by 7 feet. That's a pretty big piece of metal. It's almost as big as a sheet of plywood. And then it's, you know why they made it 3 feet by 7 feet? Because it has to go inside a box. The box is made out of plywood, and plywood comes 4x8. That's what you go to school 4 years and become an engineer for. Some fool would have designed it 4x8, and by the time they got it built, they would say, how are we going to put it in a box? So it has nothing to do with acoustical principles. What they wanted to do was get it built as big as possible and still be able to package it. Okay, now use your imagination, folks. This is a piece of sheet metal up on edge, 7 foot dimension this way and 3 foot dimension this way, inside a box, 4x8, by about 1 foot thick. And on the corners, it's suspended by a spring suspension, which is fairly tight. And in the center is a transducer, which is basically a little solenoid. It's a little tin with a coil around it. And the audio signal is amplified and fed into that, and it pushes the metal plate. It has the pins in contact with the plate, and it vibrates the plate. And the sound waves are conducted out along the plate. And then there are two pickup transducers at either ends of the plate, kind of asymmetrically placed, which do just the reverse. They pick up the vibrations in the plate and bring them out back into the board. So your echo send comes in here, and your echo returns here. Normally, the most famous plate, the standard plate that's used in most recording studios, is the EMT-140. Now, EMT-140 is kind of the studio standard echo system. It's a real good sounding echo, and it's a big box, you know, 4x8x1. Made out of, I guess they make them out of press board now. When they first came out, they were made out of plywood. And they're felt lined inside and all acoustically isolated with this big metal plate inside. They weigh over 400 pounds a piece. They're not so easy to truck around. And there's also a damper down here, which is basically a thing with felt on the end, which you can screw in with a screw handle to push against the plate. And what that does is it damps the motion of the plate, thereby decreasing the reverb time. In other words, the free plate has maximum reverb time. And as you restrict the motion of the plate by putting a damper up against the plate, the reverb time decreases. Okay? And then you can also get as an accessory a little motor with a worm drive that you control from the console with a button, and it just moves that little thing in and out, that little damper, so you can adjust the delay time without going in the other room and cranking.
Is the metal any sort of gauge?
It's just sheet steel. I don't know what the gauge of the metal is. They're making them out of stainless steel now. When they first came out, they're made out of regular, just, you know, rolled, cold rolled steel.
And six years later, there's nothing left.
Well, these things are pretty well sealed. You don't run them in a wet basement. I mean, not when you've invested $8,000 a piece in them. Okay, and you need two of them, right? So that's $16,000 for echo right there. Now, most professional studios use these things. I mean, this is the standard, industry standard. And what else can I say about this thing? It's a real good design. It has a very natural sound. And see, normally what they are is they're mono in, stereo out. What that means is you can feed, it only has one input, but two outputs. What that means is that the two outputs sound slightly different from each other. They have a slightly different sound, slightly different reverb times because of the distances between the source and the pickup is slightly different for the two of them. So you can get away with buying one right, and using it for stereo echo with mono and stereo out, right? But normally people buy two and just use one output on each one and have real true stereo echo, so you can mix at stereo echo and not have that confusion. In other words, things that are panned right just have echo right. Things that are panned left just have echo left, right? Are you with me?
Yeah.
Yeah, what? Okay. Now, EMT decided after a while that this thing was awfully big and heavy. They get shipped from Germany, you know, you got to pay all those import duties and everything, Deutsche Marks to dollars and all that. Raises the price up quite a bit. So they invented the EMT 240. EMT 240 is only about this big. And what it is, instead of having a piece of sheet metal inside, it has a diaphragm only 18 microns thick. A micron is a millionth of an inch. It's real thin, made out of solid gold foil. Okay, gold foil. And it's suspended in a frame, metal frame, and then there are little piezoelectric transducers that stimulate the foil. And the foil acts just the way this does, except on a much smaller scale. And it's cheaper, even though they make it out of gold, it's so thin, there's not that much gold in it. And then it's acoustically isolated inside two boxes, a box inside a box. Basically, you don't want to leave these things lying out in your waiting room or something, you know, if somebody comes along and says, what's that? You know, and you're mixing all this in here. You want to stick them away in the basement somewhere, you know, paint them black so that nobody gets near them, or put them in a locked closet or something. Normally these EMT units, they just look like plywood stacked up against the wall. You know, people walk by and like that. So you stick them in the basement where nobody's going to mess with them, where the rumbling of trucks going by won't affect them. They're pretty acoustically sensitive. So the idea of the foil was, A, decrease the weight and the bulk, so you have less shipping costs, less, you know, hassle to carry it around. It only weighs about 200 pounds. 150 pounds, maybe. And B, decrease the price. And C, make it less acoustically sensitive. Okay. Okay, there's now some American companies making plate echo. Two or three of them. But, you know, as far as buying an echo system for a studio you're building, listen to it before you buy it. See, the problem is in this business, there's a lot of guys who get paid a lot of money to write these great advertisements in magazines, you know. I don't know if you see in the Rolling Stone so much. Magazines like DB and, you know, REP and stuff like that, where they write these glossy ads and you're out to buy some equipment and you turn the page and you see this thing and you say, wow, that looks really hot. You know, you go and buy one of them things. And after you've had it in the studio for a couple of months, you say, I think I better put an ad in the back of DB and see if I can get rid of this thing. So, only buy something. There's two ways to buy something. I mean, this is common sense. Either get the thing on a trial situation from the dealer so you can have it for 30 days and use it, not for 3 days, 30 days. And then if you don't like it, you can return it, maybe take 2 or 3% off or restock and charge 5% something. Or talk to someone who's used it in their studio for a year or two. See how they like it. But don't just buy stuff from advertisements. I mean, maybe it's silly to say stuff like this, but you'd be surprised how many people building studios will just read some glossy ad and say, man, that sounds good, the price is right, look at all these specs, and I'll buy the thing. It sounds like shit. So, with Echo, you have to listen, and you have to see what sounds good to you, and use it under different circumstances with different types of program material and see what it sounds like. What else is there to say about plate echo? I don't know. The American versions of the EMT are cheaper, around $3,000, $4,000. I don't think they sound as good, but again, let your own ears be the judge, because that's definitely the final criteria for anything is different listening conditions and how you perceive something to sound under those conditions. I hope that they've stressed here for you how important the ears are, haven't they?
Yeah.
The whole key to this business, folks, here's the big secret, is being able to listen. I mean, everybody can talk. Everybody can do great cigar jobs and look cool and do all that stuff. The real secret is really knowing how to listen. Being able to focus your attention so that you can hear inside the music and still be able to hear like that and perceive like that and also be able to function and do everything you're doing at the same time. You have to have the perception, the ability to listen, and you also have to have all the mechanical stuff. So what usually happens in this business is you start off by being a good listener. And if you're a musician, you're already a good listener, right? You got to listen to play. You got to be able to hear inside the music. You got to be able to hear what's going on. You got to be real sensitive, you know, to pitch, to rhythm, stuff like that. And then you get into the technical aspects of it, and you kind of become all into the mixing and the doing and everything, and you're listening. The amount of focusing of your conscious mind that goes into listening goes down because you're dealing with the mechanics of it. It's like learning to ride a bicycle. Right? Once you've got it down,
it is. Remember when you learned to ride a bicycle? It ain't that easy.
You fall on your head.
Joe told us this already.
It's been like the ride. You got it all ready for the morning lecture.
About the bicycle?
Yes, kid finally learned how to ride the bike.
Bike today.
He's been listening to my old lectures. I knew he was making those tapes for some reason. Okay. I just picked that analogy out of the air. Really, the first time I've ever used it. Yeah, it just shows you what's in the air. You know,
it's still around.
When your antennas are out, you pick up all the stuff. Okay. You didn't know those were antennas? That's what grows on top of your head. Is antennas.
Hairs.
Those are your antennas. Sure.
So
you betcha. Sure. I mean, they grow to a certain natural length, and that's the natural length that's tuned for your brain to receive the proper signals. You think the engineer who designed you didn't know what he was doing? He's cool. He knew what he was doing. I mean, why didn't you put your nostrils in your elbow? Everything has a reason behind it, you know? You've got hairs on your head for a reason. They're not just there for decoration, you know? It's an energy system. Well, that's another topic. Okay. Electronic echo. I was going to go into compression and limiting too. Let's see what we can get done today. Let's be real quick about electronic echo. Electronic echo basically uses a type of device called a random access memory, RAM, which is a IC chip type of thing, or multiple IC chips. And what it does is it remembers. It's a memory like, you know, like in a calculator where you put a number in the memory and then you go back and push a button and it comes back again. It stores information. So naturally, if you take a sound and you store it and then retrieve it 30 milliseconds later, you have an echo. You get the picture?
Yeah.
It's a lot more complicated than that, but that's the basic idea. So digital delay on stuff like that work by remembering the sound, holding it for a certain amount of time, and then releasing it. That's the most basic.
Could I change the sound to digital before I store it?
Yeah, but we're going to talk about that next week. I didn't want to confuse everybody this week, because that's going to take more time to discuss. Yeah?
Can you get Ricky Pink's models of digital delay, or is it basically the same principle using all these sheets?
Digital, let's do a little market survey on digital delay before. Well, we're going to more of the theory of it next week. The king of all digital delay units, digital echo units, is again made by EMT. Those Germans are sharp, I'll tell you. It's professionally known as R2-D2. It's about this big. And it has all these handles on top. It looks like a Nautilus submarine, you know? Captain Nemo.
Yeah.
Remember how that submarine had all those great knobs and everything inside? Well, this thing really looks like that. It looks like something from 1890. And it stands up about this high. It's got a sloping front and all these knobs and levers and big numbers. You know how German things are? Big numbers, you know, really Teutonic. Anyway, costs about $24,000, and it'll do just about anything. It's got a fan in back to cool off the ICs. It's got 800 and some odd IC chips in it. It's really loaded with IC chips, and even though they're refining it, and the IC chips they make nowadays have more memory capacity. This thing is really the state of the art in digital echo and reverb. It can produce any kind of echo or reverb effect. It can produce completely unnatural effects where your frequency components all have the same Decay Time. It was used on the last, the Jay Giles album, Before Last. Listen to it.
Sanctuary?
Yeah. Listen to the cymbal sound and stuff on that. It has a really distinct, very sharp kind of echo. It was produced by that EMT echo unit. I think it's called a 550 or something like that. I don't remember the number. Anyway, that's the top of the line, and it goes down from there. They produce a simpler version of that called, I think, the 424, which only has echo in it. It doesn't have any of the space effects and reverb effects and stuff in it. It's just straight echo. And then you get into units like the, let's see, there's the, well, the most famous one that people are buying now is a Lexicon 224. You've read some of the ads for that. That's about $8,300. The digital echo is expensive if you want quality. I'm talking about good ones first. Rinky-dink ones is something else. The Lexicon is completely software programmed. You can produce any kind of echo sound you want. It takes some time. It's programmed externally. It's a little microcomputer. And it's a very versatile sound. You can produce a lot of natural sounds with it, a lot of unnatural sounds with it. It's a really useful thing. Again, it's expensive, but if you compare it to the price of an EMT plate or two EMT plates, it's not that expensive and it's more versatile. So Lexicon 224, again, listen to it first, is a good device. There are cheaper digital echo units. And let's, at this point, not confuse a digital echo unit with a digital delay. They're two different things. A digital delay will produce a discrete one echo, one delay. It's used for something like vocal doubling or, you know, instrumental track doubling, where you want to produce a fuller sound. Let's say you have one fiddle player, right? You know, and you want it to sound like two fiddle players. And you don't have two fiddle players. You can take another track and you can overdub, right? You can add another fiddle on it. Or you can bounce tracks and make it two fiddles, three fiddles, bounce it back and forth, have the guy play the part 12 times in unison, have a whole song section. And of course, the noise increases each time, and it sounds like bounce tracks back and forth. Or you can use a doubler, and the way it works is it just delays the sound less than 30 milliseconds and mixes that sound back in with the original sound through the board, right? And so when it comes to your ears, since there's that split-second difference, not enough for you to actually hear two violins playing, but enough to make the sound fuller because there's a slight delay in attack between the beginnings of the notes. Do you understand?
Yeah.
Have you all heard that?
Yeah.
You experienced that. Okay. Works with vocals, too. So you can produce that doubling effect, that fullness. You can either double track it, you can feed it through a doubler, a digital delay line. Digital delay lines can also be used for special effects. If you increase the delay beyond 30 milliseconds, you get a slap echo effect out of the digital delay line. You add a slap echo effect and feed it back into the input, you can get an echo repeating effect, right? Where you have a guitar note, and you stop the guitar note, and it goes ding, 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 like that, or you can repeat a word, the last word of a phrase that you're singing, something like that. So it can be used for special effects. They have a harmonizer.
Harmonizer, yeah.
Which has got two digital delay lines built into it. They have another digital delay unit or just that?
No, they have one in Studio B, I think.
They do? Well, next week, or whenever I come back here, we'll talk about how digital delays work in more electronic detail. And we'll also talk about how the harmonizer works, how it harmonizes. But I want to take the last part of this lecture to talk about compression and limiting, with the understanding that you're a little unsatisfied with digital delay because we haven't really gotten into what digital is, and that's part of the next lecture. So what you haven't learned about electronic echo will be added to and expanded on next time, okay? You got a deal?
Yeah, okay.
Okay. Let's talk about compression and limiting in half an hour. What is a compressor? What does it do?
He's
looking at his nose. Tell me what it is.
It's an amplifier that takes a hot signal and keeps it level.
Yeah. That's what it's basically. You've talked about these things already.
Not really.
Read about it, whatever.
Read about it.
Okay. I told you I was going to talk about it. Okay. Well, a compressor is a device that allows you to record a sound that has a large dynamic range in a medium that has a small dynamic range. Okay? It's a dynamic range reducer. You all know what dynamic range is, right?
Yeah.
In other words, if you have an instrument that has a particularly loud attack, or one that plays at a wide range of volumes, like the human voice, or like a bass, or a piano or something, where 1 minute your meter is pegged, and the next minute it's a real soft passage, and you don't want to constantly be riding that gain control all the time, the compressor acts like an invisible hand. It sits next to you at the console, and then simply when it gets too loud, it turns the fader down. You don't even have to do anything, right? It's just like somebody sitting next to you, and their only job is to watch the meter and turn the fader down when it gets too loud, and keep the volume within certain limits. Isn't that a pretty good explanation of what a compressor does?
Yeah.
You understand the concept?
Yeah.
That's all you have to know about what it does. Don't talk about how it works. Here's our graph again. And this time, we're going to change what's in this graph. We're going to put output on the y-axis and input on the x-axis. In a unity gain situation, you have a line with a slope of 45 degrees, which means that as the input increases, so the output increases. Okay, this is a unity gain amplifier, an amplifier that as you increase the input, the output increases linearly with the input, okay? So you have a straight line, right, with a slope of 1, okay? Now, what a compressor is if you take an arbitrary point on this line, which is variable, and you say to yourself, let's put some gradations here, let's call this plus 1 dB, or VU, plus 2, plus 3, and this would be 0, minus 1, minus 3, minus 8, minus 11, whatever it is, okay? Okay, I don't see any hands going out there. Everybody's cool. Now, well, let's say we arbitrarily pick this point of plus 1 dB, and we're going to say that whenever the signal goes above 1 dB, you want to tell your little invisible buddy to start turning the volume down, right? Because you don't want to get distortion. So above that point, what happens is this. As the input increases, the output does not increase at the same rate. In other words, the gain of the amplifier decreases as the input increases. Yeah?
I noticed that the dotted line of the compressed signal, you have it kind of going up. It doesn't stay constant.
No. As the input increases, the output still increases, but it increases much less. Okay? Now, the amount of decrease is expressed as a ratio called compression ratio. If this ratio is 1 to 1, which gives you a slope of 1, right? Basic geometry, folks, right? Now we look at this one. This maybe has a different slope of 1 to, this one, let's call this 4, 1 to 4, okay? So we call this a compression ratio of 4 to 1, okay? What that means is that as the output increases 4 units, the input increases 4 units, the output only increases 1 unit. Is everyone following?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good. Okay. Now, you can have different compression ratios. You can have a compression ratio of 2 to 1, right? You can have a compression ratio of 8 to 1. Different compression ratios. Varying the compression ratio varies how much the output will increase in amplitude for a given increase in input amplitude. Okay? Good. The point where the compressor begins to act is called the threshold. Okay, now, you have almost all the information you need to discuss how to use a compressor. One more point of information, which is a limiter. A limiter is simply a compressor that has a compression ratio of 10 to 1 or greater. Okay, if the compression ratio is greater to or equal than 10 to 1, it's called a limiter. That's the only difference between a limiter and a compressor. A limiter is a compressor. Except for all intents and purposes, this becomes almost a straight line, right? Because the slope of the line is so much less that it appears almost to be a horizontal line. So what a limiter does is, no matter how much you increase the input above plus 1, the output just stays at plus 1, essentially. In other words, you set a limit, a threshold, and above that limit, no matter how much the input goes up, the output just stays. And as soon as your input falls below that limit, the output just falls down with it. But once it goes above that threshold, that limit, It just stays, the output stays at the same level no matter what the input does. The input can be up here going up and down, and the output just stays the same. In other words, just chops it, right? Yeah.
Can I try to apply this to something that's easier? Let's say you've got some guy, some real dummy, in the studio who can't hit a cowbell, you know, with the same amount of intensity. So you can set your compressor and limiter, no matter how soft or how hard he hits it, it's going to remain the same.
Yeah, you can do that. That's one of the things you can do with it. That's a good picture. Or you may have a vocalist, for instance, that one minute they're singing like this, and the next minute they're singing like this, you know? And you want to kind of even it out a little, so not suddenly smashing it into the red, you know, and you want to even it out. See, when you want to even out differences in volume, you use a compressor. You can also use a compressor to create a more definite sound. For instance, the sound of a bass. For instance, if you pick a bass closer to the bridge, it sounds different than if you pick it further away, right? If you use, if you finger pick, or if you, you know, don't use picks, but play with your fingers, or if you use a plectrum pick, you get a different kind of sound. Just a second. So, for instance, if you want to get a more defined, a tight, you know, Motown-type bass sound, that real tight, funky bass sound, what you want to do is you want to boost that bass sound up, equalize it, and then put it through a compressor so that you can keep the level steady and high, and yet have that tight sound. See, so you can use it to create certain effects, to create certain types of sound. Yeah, what's your question?
Would you use an equalizer for recording on the tape? When you put it on tape, would you use it then, or would you use it for me when you're remixing?
Sure. You know, it's like saying, do you like Suzuki's or Kawasaki's? I mean, you know, it depends on what your style is, or Triumphs or Beezers, whatever it is. If you like, for instance, you have a certain way of recording bass. For instance, here's one way I record bass. Okay, for instance, you record bass both direct and with an amp. Okay, right? You put them on two different tracks and you equalize both of them. Okay, and then you take those two and put them back together in the mix, and you get a combination of direct and acoustic bass. Okay, you can create all kinds of fantastic bass sounds by doing that. It takes an extra track to do it, but you can create some great sounds with it. Yeah, that's one way of doing it. But there are many different ways of recording a bass. Whether you equalize when you're recording direct or equalize in the mix is largely dependent on how familiar you are. You know what kind of sound you want, you know what it's going to sound like. You're familiar with it, you're secure with it, you've done it before, you just dial it in, you do it, that's your sound. And you'll listen to that and they'll say, what's your name?
Herbert.
But listen to them, they'll say, man, that's Herbert's sound, you know? That's his sound, you know? And they'll come back to your studio and they'll say, well, they'll want you because you got that sound. So that's what the business is, yeah.
Is it true that, like, your strongness or your strongest tones will be compressed down and your softer tones will be brought up because
no. He said, does it mean your louder tones will be compressed down and your softer tones will be brought up? Nothing happens to your softer tones except this. I'm going to erase this again. Suppose you take, here's an amplitude versus time picture again. And let's say this is just a musical line, a piece of program. And sometimes it's louder, sometimes it's softer, sometimes it's louder and then softer. If you compress it, okay, what you're going to do is you're going to decrease the high parts. Decrease the dynamic range, okay, like this. This is the compressed signal. Now, if you boost the gain, in other words, put your fader up, okay, what your tendency is going to be now is you restore these back to the height where they were. In other words, your loud sounds are just as loud as they would be. Then your low sounds come up too, and that's what gives you that punch. You understand?
Yeah.
So if the compressor itself doesn't make the low sounds louder, but you have the ability then to bring your fader up higher without overloading, to give the low sounds more punch. See? Okay. Now, I think, what are they? These Urey compressors here?
Yeah. With the little dials on.
Okay. Do you know how to use them?
Yeah.
You know how to use them? Some do, some don't. Let's just quickly discuss what the controls are on the front of a compressor. By the way, when to use a limiter? Let's just get this out of the way. You don't normally use a limiter in the recording studio. A limiter is used for mastering. When you go from tape to disc, you don't want to overmodulate because, you know, plastic has certain elastic limits. Cutter heads have certain things that burn out in them. And so you don't want to exceed certain levels. So when you master, and by the way, mastering engineer is a far out job. Is Larry Bodman here to talk to you? Is he coming?
No.
He's a mastering engineer for MCA. He usually comes to the workshop and talks here. He talks a little about the job of the mastering engineer. who takes your final mix that you've sweated over, your two-track tape that you've mixed out, you stayed up till 4 a.m., you've gotten it, finally you've given up and said, okay, that's it, I can't do any better. And you send it out, and then you get the record back, and you say, wow, what did he do to it? Okay, or you say, wow, it sounds better than my mix. A whole lot depends on the mastering engineer. A whole lot, because don't forget, the whole thing is re-equalized and fed through a limiter before it's put on the disc. Huh? After all that work? Yeah. And a good mastering engineer can actually take a tape and make it sound better. You can have a disc that sounds better than the tape. It may not have the dynamic range of the tape, but it may have a better sound, more commercial sound. It may sound worse. So mastering engineers are really critical link. The limiters are used there. Limiters are also used in broadcasting. Anybody who's familiar with radio and TV, you can't overmodulate. FCC regulations that call you up and say, $50,000. They overmodulated on February 28th at 4 p.m. They got these listening trucks out there, and they keep eyes, especially on commercial stations, because they know where they are. It's not like you can pick up and move. So you have to have certain inspections regularly from the FCC. You have to meet certain criteria, and you have to log and modulate. Somebody's nodding your head back there. She's worked for a commercial radio station. No, you know what the story is, though. Radio stations, what they try to do is play as loud as possible without overmodulating, right? It gives you a basically shitty sound that if you're in your car and you're tuning across the dial, all of a sudden you hear boom, 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 damn, listen to that. You know, it's loud. So that's how they get their market, you know, except people are getting a little more sophisticated now, and car stereo systems are getting a little more sophisticated. But especially AM radio, you know, they just pump it up as loud as they can. It has no dynamic range at all. Dynamic range is maybe 3 dB.
I heard that coming in about the next 5 months that the AM stereo is going to go stereo. So what's that going to do to the...
It's going to sell a lot of radio.
Sell a lot of radio.
Okay. Okay, quickly, here's a URI compressor. They're all basically the same. It's got a dial in the middle, and it's got a little switch that says output, or GR, which you can switch it to. It's got an input gain control, and it's got a series of buttons or switches or dials, something that says compression ratio. And some of them have two knobs that say attack and release. I'll just call them A and R. Okay, let's quickly go over how to use this thing. First of all, how do you set the threshold? The answer is this, you don't. The thing has a built-in threshold. It's built into it, and you can't adjust it. So how do you determine where you want it to start acting? It's very simple. You turn up the input gain, right? Because as you turn up the input gain, it's effectively changing the threshold, because the threshold is fixed. As the input gain increases, the threshold will start at different points in your signal, right? Depending on how loud your input to the compressor is. Do you follow that?
Right, yes.
Okay, if you don't, just raise your hand. Okay, now how do you know when the compressor starts acting? You flip the switch to GR, which says gain reduction. The meter needle rests on zero. As soon as the compressor starts to act, the needle starts to bounce down, backwards, just the opposite of a normal VU meter. Normally a VU meter goes up as the amplitude increases. As soon as you pass threshold, this meter starts to kick down. And what it's showing you is the number of dB of gain reduction. Okay, so if this thing starts kicking down from 0 to minus 3, it's showing you that as the signal exceeds threshold, it's decreasing the output 3 dB. Okay? The other mode of this meter is to flip it to output, and then it just reads normally. It goes up as the amplitude goes up, and it shows you the output signal gain. It shows you what's coming out of the compressor, so you can balance it back to the board onto your tape. Okay? So you flip it to GR, and you adjust your gain until the thing starts to kick down at the point where you want it to act. You set your compression ratio, whatever it is, 4 to 1, 2 to 1, 3 to 1, for the kind of sound you want. And normally, I would say, about 4 to 1 is normally kind of what you use in the studio. When do you want more? Well, when you feel the compressor isn't giving you enough condensation of the dynamic range, you still feel it's too wide of range. You kick in more compression, so it gives you a tighter sound. The other two adjustments, which are normally on these things, are attack and release. And the way that works is this. The attack knob tells the compressor how fast it acts when the gain exceeds the threshold. In other words, you want it basically to act faster than you can hear. Because if suddenly the sound gets loud, and then your invisible buddy who's sitting there says, oh, it sounds like it's getting louder. I better turn the gain down. All right. That's a slow attack time. All right? A fast attack time is when that guy is so fast that you haven't even heard it get loud and he's already pulling the game down, right? That's a basic idea. So the attack time normally is reduced. You turn the knob fully counterclockwise so you have the shortest attack time possible. So the thing just cuts in immediately as soon as the sound exceeds the threshold. Why would you want a longer attack time? You create special effects. You ever heard of backwards drum track?
Yeah. Hendrix did it on Are You Experienced.
Yeah, he was one of the first ones to do it, too. And among a lot of other first things he did. But backwards drum tracks are now pretty common, and they have a real unique sound. You know, it goes, it sounds backwards. The decay is first, the decay becomes the attack, and the attack becomes the release. You understand? Huh? Styx what? Styx does it, too. A lot of people do it now. Okay, you can create that kind of effect by setting the thing on a slow attack time and a fast release. So what the thing does is it lets the sound increase, and all of a sudden it cuts in and compresses, and it gives you that kind of backwards sound. You can use it as a special effect, or you could actually take your drum track and reverse it. But you can use it for special effects. The release time, what that tells the compressor is there's a loud sound, and then the loud sound is over. How fast does the compressor return the gain back up to the proper level? How fast does it let go, okay, from turning down? How fast does it bring the fader back up again, right? Now you think, well, gee, why don't you bring it up fast? Well, suppose someone's singing, and there's just a pause while they take a breath, and the compressor goes back up again. What happens? You hear all the background noise come up, right? And then as soon as they start singing, all the background noise drops down again, and you hear this strange whooshing sound in the background, which is the background noise going whoop, up and down, every time there's a little pause. Yeah, that's called breathing. That's what it's called, the technical term breathing. See, the compressor is breathing. Now, you listen to almost any record that has a compressor on a vocal, for instance. I mean, Steve Miller Band album, any of these albums, you know, vocals prominent. Listen with headphones, you'll hear, when the person stops singing, you'll hear the noise level come up. You know, and then you'll hear it go back down again. What you want to do as an engineer is you want to reduce that breathing sound as much as possible. So what you have to do is you set the release time for maximum, and then you turn it down until you begin to hear the thing breathing, okay? And just at that point, in other words, you want it to release quickly, but you don't want it to release so quickly that you hear sudden variations in the background noise, because when that thing releases, it increases the gain on everything, including the noise, right? So to create a more even sound, you dial your release time to the slowest release time, and then turn it back so you hear the thing begin to breathe, and that's kind of where you set it. That's just a rule of thumb. Okay, so that's how to use a compressor. Okay, we only got about 5 minutes left, so I thought we'd just kind of wrap it up and see if anybody has any questions about what we talked about today. So kind of change back through your notes, yeah.
How would you know how to set the...
Right. His question was, how would you know how to set the compressor? Does it have to do with the amount of headroom you have on the tape? Does it have to do with, you know, how do you know where to set it? The answer to that is, first you have to know that you want to use a compressor at all. The way you know that is your sound has too much dynamic range. The meter needle is flying all over the place, and you can't get a good red line, you can't get a good level set on the recording. Or you want to produce a certain special effect, whatever it is. And then you put the compressor in, you patch it in through the patch bay, okay? So you can vary the input gain to the compressor through the fader, and the output gain back into the mix with the gain control on the compressor, right? Set the thing up, and then you feed your signal through it, and you have to stop the music at that point and listen to the instrument that you're compressing, or the voice, and dial the compressor in so you get the kind of thing you want. If you're using it for gain reduction purposes, not for special effects, you watch your meter and you tell the person to sing bars 28 through 34, whatever it is, which is the loud part. You haven't laid up to it, and they'll sing it loud, and then you say, no, I'll sing it the way you really sing it. Let it really wail, and then you set the gain where you want it, and then go back and do a take with it, you see? So it's kind of trial and error, and you get a feel for it after a while. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
A lot of compressors have, like, automatic attack and release settings. They take care of that themselves. Are those any good, or are they just a compromise?
No. They're good, but you can't use it for special effects. But for normal music, a pre-programmed attack and release is okay. You know, a lot of them are like that. I don't know whether the Uris are like that or not. I think they are. Yeah.
if you don't have to run right out of here, can I ask you a couple questions out of class?
Yeah, I'll be around for a few minutes, sure. Yeah.
Be 2 meters on there for dials that we have on the book.
Do you have meters or dials?
Yeah. Is there one up there facing the picture?
Oh. There's one VU meter, and there's 1, 2, 3, 4 knobs, and 3 buttons.
Mine's got 2 dials.
Yours has 2 dials. It's a stereo, compressor, yes?
No, I think we have 2.
No, no, you know what it is? It's 2 compressors side by side
right.
In 19-inch rack.
That's what it is.
Each one takes up half the rack space. It's stereo, right? It's just 2 identical compressors side by side, yeah.
With the 5 different ways you listed to create the echo, in the studio, which one of those 5 would be best to use in the studio, or is used? Is there a difference? Why would you do it?
Wow, he's asking a
question. Do you like JBL speakers, or do you like,
I mean, it's personal preference.
It's a personal preference. It's what you like. Some guys will swear by plates and say, man, EMT-140 has never been anything like it. Another guy's used the Lexicon 224 for a year and half, about a year, been refined. He'll say, man, this is the ultimate in echo. I mean, the ultimate is depending on who's doing the ultimating, you know. It's a lot of it subjective. I'm not going to sit here and say, this is the best, you know. I happen to like the sound of EMT plates, but as you get into experimenting with digital, I mean, the ideal situation, right, is you have some EMT plates, all right, and you have an EMT 550 R2-D2 digital for $25,000, and you're in good shape. But if you don't have that much money to spend, you have to go around and listen to a bunch of different stuff and pick what fits in your budget and still sounds good. In the low-budget type of stuff, Mic Mix is a good choice for springs. They're inexpensive. They make a cheap one now for about $1,200. It has a good spring sound. And there's the American plates that are about $2,500, $3,000. They're also pretty good. In that type of price range, when you go cheaper than that, you're going to get a boingy type of spring echo. You know, the problem in this industry is there's cheap stuff and there's expensive stuff. And lately they've tried to bring out in-the-middle type stuff like Otari, you know. But the problem is that it really boils down to either you're going to go to the whole hog or you're not. And what usually happens is you start off buying cheap stuff, and as you start to make some bucks, you buy expensive stuff and work into it, you know, but you don't want your cheap stuff to sound real funky. So you have to set a budget, and then you have to decide where your trade-offs are. Obviously, your console and your tape machine are your primary quality items, and your microphones. And your echo usually doesn't have so much left in the budget. By the time you've bought some, you know, good AKG mics and bought a good console and stuff, you don't have that many bucks left to buy a good echo. So sometimes people will skimp on that. But, you know, I would say if you want to spend less than $1,500 for echo, you're going to be making some kind of compromise. You got to budget at least that much for echo. Okay, anything else? Okay, well, thank you all for being here. I had a lot of fun, and I'll be back. I'll drive down here again next week. I think it's 2 weeks. And we'll continue this discussion. We'll talk about digital and digital recording and digital delay and stuff. Go into more detail about the technical aspects of it. Okay?